Hey everyone, Into the Verse is sort of a new project here at Aleph Beta, and we'd really love your feedback. So if you're enjoying the show, or if there's something you don't enjoy about it, please send us an email at info@alephbeta.org and share your thoughts. We love your feedback. Okay, here's the show. Welcome back to Into the Verse, where we share new and unexpected insights about the Parsha, diving deep into the verses to uncover the Torah's own commentary on itself. Hi, I'm Imu Shalev. This week's Torah portion is Nusso, except for our Israeli listeners who are reading Parshat Behalotcha this week. Today, we're going to look at the section of Parshat Nusso which can be a bit uncomfortable to discuss. The Sota, the wayward woman who is suspected of adultery. You don't hear the word wayward much anymore, do you? So for this wayward woman, whose husband has accused her of being intimate with another man, the Torah outlines a bizarre ritual. She comes before the priest, and he makes a mixture of water and dust from the tabernacle floor. Then he takes a scroll of parchment, which details this very law, and dissolves it into the water. And then he gives it to the woman to drink. If she was guilty, she would die a gruesome death. But if she was innocent, then she would not only survive, but would become pregnant. And if I'm being honest, I find this whole thing a bit hard to relate to. If a buddy of mine were having trust issues in his marriage, it's not like I would say, "All right, friend, it's time to bust out the mei sota. You know, the waters of waywardness. That's what you and your wife need." So how exactly should we relate to the law of sota? Sure, it would be easy to shy away from asking these questions and to talk about something more comfortable, but let's not shy away. Instead, let's go into the verse. This week, Rabbi David Foreman sits down with a member of the Aleph Beta family, Rivki Stern, to tackle the mystery of the Sota. Just an editorial note, what you're about to listen to is from a product at Aleph Beta known as Parshalab. Parshalab is a little bit different from some of the other Aleph Beta courses that we've shared with you thus far on Into the Verse. What makes it different is that it lets you see how we learn Torah at the beginning of our process, before the ideas have gone through multiple revisions and been polished by producers and editors. It's just two scholars sitting down to have an informal, unscripted conversation about the text. So what you're about to hear from Rabbi Foreman and Rivki, it's a fascinating conversation, well worth a listen, but it's a bit incomplete. But don't worry, I'm going to pop back in at the end so we can find some resolution together. All right, here's Rabbi Foreman and Rivki.
Rivki, what I want to talk to you about today is an idea that we have been batting around a little bit with the office. It began with an observation by Emmanuel Shalev of a tantalizing possible clue that, you know, I spent some time thinking about and I think might be the beginning of something here. The backstory is that this has to do with a section of text in this week's Parsha that has to do with the Sota. Rivki, you want to give our listeners a little bit of the backstory here on the Sota?
Sure. Basically, I think the laws of the Sota deal with a marriage in crisis. There is a man who is very suspicious of his wife, and she doesn't do anything to sort of make that suspicion go away. She ends up being alone with another man after he warned her not to be alone with that man, and then she is brought to have some sort of ritual with the Kohen, with the priest, to find out whether she actually cheated on her husband.
And it's a very strange ritual. That's
yes.
Correct. It just is mysterious. One of the most mysterious things you're going to find in Sefer Bamidbar. She goes before the Kohen. And by the way, it should be emphasized that this is entirely voluntary, right? She doesn't need to submit to this process. As you correctly noted, the marriage is in crisis. It seems to be the victim of mutual suspicion or mutual anger or mutual scorn. The husband is jealous in the words of the text, right? Possibly paranoid, possibly justified. We don't know. He doesn't know. He goes and he asks his wife or almost makes a demand of her and says, I need you to not be in intimate seclusion with this other man. I think there might be something going on between you guys. And, basically instead of them kind of working it out together and somehow achieving some kind of reassurance in the normal way that couples would handle these things, she seems to invite two witnesses to watch her flaunt that warning. It's like, come here, Bob and Sam. Watch
Trouble
me go secluded
indeed.
With Phil. Yes, a troubled marriage indeed. And so she scorns this and secludes herself with this guy, almost as if to taunt him.
She purposely is alone with this man in front of witnesses.
Right. And in front of the witnesses is the weird thing. It's like, you know, if you were going to have an affair, it's not like, hey, Phil and Sam, watch me go upstairs and right. seclude myself in the bedroom with Bob. That's an act of spite. That's not an act of romance. So I think it's correct when you say this is a marriage on the rocks. Right. It's almost more on the rocks because of the mutual suspicion and scorn than it is on the rocks by whatever might or might not be happening with this imagined or possibly imagined affair. And this is sort of the background with Sota. And basically the Torah seems to be creating the situation where if she wants, she can sort of create a reset in the marriage. There's a ceremony that will either exonerate her or implicate her. She drinks these waters, very strange waters, these waters that are mixed by the Kohen, almost feels like a witch's brew. We got this.
Yeah, that was my first instinct also.
There's some dust from the ground on the.
It felt like the witches of Macbeth, right?
It does. And you've got the scroll where this curse, this feels like it's Harry Potter, where this curse is erased. The letters of the curse, including God's name, is erased in the waters. And she drinks this. And if she's in fact guilty of adultery, she'll die. Miraculously. And if she is in fact not guilty of adultery, nothing's going on, then not only will she survive the encounter, but she'll be guaranteed by God that if she's childless, she'll become pregnant and will be blessed, with his lineage, which may have previously
Right, which also sort of seems strange, right? Because when this marriage is in crisis, assuming she's exonerated, it's sort of strange to imagine that this is a couple that should really be having children. So I think that's another sort of question mark for us.
And what it seems to indicate is that there is the possibility, actually, of saving the marriage, that there is something that could happen here that would be constructive in terms of allaying the sort of mutual suspicion and scorn which has crept into the marriage, right? You can imagine this paranoid guy who's really worried about his wife and Bob. She's saying to him, look, there's nothing going on between me and Bob. The marriage has gotten to this point where he can't even accept her reassurances, right? You can imagine this guy thinking, if only there would be a sign from heaven, right? If only I could have some sort of objective clarification here, right? Then somehow that can make it all better. What's happening over here is God coming out of the clouds and saying, I'm willing to be that verification. I'm willing to provide that kind of reset. And this is sort of the background with Sota. What I wanted to share with you was an idea, an interesting intertextual hint, actually, which Emmanuel suggested, and I've been kind of running down over the last day or so, and I think that it's rather tantalizing. There seems to be another text sort of hovering over kind of a phantom Sota story. I wonder, could it be that this earlier story in the Torah somehow becomes a template, as strange as it may sound, for the weird stuff in the Sota, which might go some way to explaining the weird ritual, by the way, because it could be that the weird ritual is some sort of replay of the original story. Let's play our little game. Where have we heard these ideas before? Where have we heard these words before? Here's the data, folks. If you look at the ritual of the Sota, so one of the things that happens is that there is this elaborate curse, which is drawn up on a scroll, and then it is placed in the waters, right? And these waters are these strange waters, and they're called cursed bitter waters. If you look at the language over here, and I refer you to verse 23, in what chapter are we up to? Chapter 5 in Bamidbar in Numbers. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that verse, V'chatavet alot ha'ilah ha'kon ba'sefer u'macha el me'hamarim, that you write these curses down, and the Kohen erases them, right? Macha el me'hamarim, and you erases them in these bitter waters, a specific erasure of God's name, as well as the erasure of all the other words along with these curses. So here you've got something being erased in waters. If you think about these waters, another element of the waters, which is really kind of interesting, is that there's something else that's mixed in the water, and it's dirt from the floor of the Mishkan. He has to take dirt, dust from the floor of the Mishkan and mix that into the waters. You know, a really strange sort of brew over here. And so the question I would ask you, right, is does this remind you of any earlier episode in the Torah, especially perhaps given the language of Sota itself? I refer you to verse 12. Dabar al b'nei sova amarta lehem ish ish ki tista ishto u'ma'ala b'ma'al. The language for Sota is me'ila, which is a Hebrew word that is spelled mem ayin lamed, mem ayin lamed hey, or mem ayin lamed, ma'ala b'ma'al. It means to trespass, right? A woman is suspected of trespassing against her husband. But it turns out that this other story seems to involve all of these elements and more. What other story involves water? What other story involves the erasure of something in water? What other story involves dirt, right, getting erased and muddied in that water too? And what other story also has that word mem ayin lamed associated with the erasure of those waters with all the dirt and all of that? So, Rivki, what do you say? Where have we heard these words before?
I think the first instinct when it comes to water is, I think all of our first instincts when it comes to water, which is the flood story from Genesis. And I think we have some of these common links here. So the erasure is obviously the erasure of humanity, everyone except for Noah and his family. And dirt as well, right? We have, or if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have in the story of Noah this idea that the land too, it gets mixed in with the water, and it's all used to sort of destroy the earth.
But how does the water get mixed in with the land, right?
Well, it's a flood.
It's a flood.
It grabs all the land.
It grabs all the land. God is raining water on the land. And also, Rivki, it's not just the ideas, it's the actual words. So the words of erasure, right, that specific Hebrew word that describes the erasure of God's name into the waters. In Hebrew, it's macha. You see it there in the flood. So I'd refer you, if you open up your Tanakh, go back to chapter 6 in Genesis, verse 7. Vayomer Hashem emcha, right? I will erase man. Now, it could have had a lot of words to describe. I'm going to kill man. I'm going to destroy man. But no, I'm going to erase man that I have created from upon the face of the earth. And by the way, Rivki, where does man come from?
Man comes from the earth itself. Man comes from Adama, and now we are erasing man.
You're erasing. You see what's happening. You're taking the, and where, and what's the Hebrew word from the land that he's, that man comes from? Specifically, what does God take? Vayikach?
Afar min ha'adama.
Afar. There's that word.
Uh-huh,
and
cool.
What are you supposed to put in the Sota's thing?
Min ha'afar
asher yeba'arka. And you're supposed to erase that in the waters too. Well, in the original waters, man that originally came from afar was erased in the waters. And it's like man went back to the dirt. There's this water raining on the dirt of the land, and this water raining on man. And it's as if all the men dissolve and go back to the dirt. It's like it's the same thing happening. It's almost like it's a recreation of these floodwaters. And then you've got this ma'al word too.
Right. Ma'al is the one we're still missing.
So take a look at verse 7 again in chapter 6. In the flood, can you find the phantom ma'al?
Let me read out loud. Vayomer Hashem, and God says, Emcha et ha'adam, so we have that macha word, I will erase man, asher barati me'al p'nei ha'adama, who was created from the face of the earth, me'al.
The word ma'al in the story,
very cute,
right, in the story of the Sota is a play on words, perhaps, of the me'al p'nei ha'adama, right, from upon the face of the land. And that's not just this, right? Take a look at the type of offering, the offering which accompanies the Sota procedure is. And I refer you back into Bamidbar Hay, and now look at Pasuk Tet Vav. So we're looking at chapter 5 in Numbers, verse 15.
Ki minchat kinot hi, because this is a mincha of jealousy. Minchat zikaron, maskeret avon, because it is a mincha of memorial or of remembrance in some way.
Right, some sort of remembrance, a mincha, some sort of offering of remembrance, as if the deeds of this woman are going to be remembered for ill or for good. If she's innocent, that's going to be remembered to be exonerated. If she's guilty, that'll be remembered. So there's some kind of din, some sort of judgment involving remembrance. And now take a look, let's couple that with something else here in Sota. Take a look at verse 14, read the beginning of that and put this together and tell me what in the flood does it remind you of?
Va'avar alav ruach kina, and the spirit of jealousy came upon him. V'kine et ishto, and he is jealous and I think, way.
Look at those first three words. Va'avar alav ruach. What does that remind you of the flood? Va'avar alav ruach. In context, it means that a feeling of jealousy passes over him. But the word ruach doesn't literally mean feeling, right? What does ruach literally mean?
Ruach is a wind of some sort. It's a spirit.
So what does a wind passing over remind you of in the flood?
That feels like the ending of the flood itself.
Ah, it is the ending of the flood. So what the beginning of the sota is the end of the flood. Right. The beginning of the sota is the feeling of jealousy that triggers all of this. The end of the flood is what? Take a look at chapter 8 in the book of Genesis, the very beginning.
Vayizkor Elohim et Noach, and God remembered Noach.
Oh,
there's that zikaron.
Remembrance. There's that zikaron.
Yes.
And what happened when God remembered Noach?
At the end of the pasuk, Vayaver Elohim ruach al haaretz, and God made this ruach, this wind, pass over the earth.
Fascinating, right? So at the very end of the flood story, there's another kind of zikaron, which is a mirror image of the sota kind. The sota is a feeling of jealousy that triggers what ultimately may become a destructive event for this marriage and for the woman and for everything, right? But at the end of the flood, you have another kind of remembrance, which is actually life-saving, which is God's remembrance, which is exactly the same words, right?
And that's also the zikaron for her, right? For the zikaron for the sota, in some ways, is meant to sort of be the first step in the reparation of the relationship.
Exactly, because it can be. Let's go back to the reset we talked about before, right? The hope of the reset. If you can put paranoia and jealousy behind him on his side, and you can put scorn and anger and retribution behind her on this side, like if you really think about what's gone wrong in their marriage, what's gone in their marriage is that their marriage has become a terrible clash of power dynamics. It's like the love has seeped out of this in a strange kind of way. I wonder if something like that, is it the case that when God remembers Noah, and God causes a wind to blow upon the waters to kind of begin the possibility of restoration of the world, right? If you think about the blessing and the curse, right? There's a curse going on here. There's cursed waters here in the flood too. The cursed waters have destroyed man, but they've saved one man, right? And what's the blessing that Noah gets immediately after this?
Lo osif lekalel od et ha'adamah.
So there you go.
Wow, that's where lekalel, that curse.
There it is, right? I'm never again going to curse the land through water like I've done here. Cursed waters. And instead, what does he say to Noah? I have a job for you. You're supposed to come out, and what's your job?
To have children.
Oh, you have to have
children. Wow, just like the sota. The sota is blessed with children as part of the reparation of their relationship. So, Rabbi Foreman, I think just to put things together and maybe spell things out more clearly, one of the things that we were saying at the beginning of this podcast episode was that it looks like this relationship between husband and wife is in disarray, and it's almost at the verge of completely breaking apart, and there being no way to resolve it. And what hopefully the sota laws do is they sort of start to maybe repair the relationship. It's almost at the point of being broken completely, but maybe this can repair it. But I think in some ways, it was a little bit of just a theory. But now that we can connect it to Noach, and those connections feel very real, right? The textual connections, and there are also thematic connections here. And it seems like the story of Noach is also about a relationship that is in disarray, this relationship in disrepair. And that's the relationship between humanity and God, right? God's looking at the people of the world. What is with these people? I created them. I was happy with them, but look what they're doing to each other. Look at their right. Ki raba ra'ata adam ba'aretz, the kol yeter machshavot libo, rak ra kol hayom.
It doesn't sound that a lot like the accusation of a jealous husband, of an angry husband. It's like, you're always bad. You know what I mean? And maybe you are always bad, but I guess I'm not sure. And I invite our listeners to kind of consider this, right? But it seems like it might be that there is a precedent for a sota in the stories. As you talked about before, our laws seem to emerge out of our stories. And it seems that the law of the sota might be hearkening back to an original kind of me sota, the waters of the sota, which could either destroy or heal. In the case of the humanity, it destroys some people, and it then these waters provide for blessing in a way. They are the life-saving for Noah, which is immune to them, almost as if the exonerated person is immune to them, right? And I wonder, this is completely speculative, and I could be completely off here, but let me maybe close out our little podcast with the following possible thought, understanding that it's just possible. One of the greatest puzzles of the Noah story is that the reason why God destroys the world is suspiciously similar to the reason why after the flood, he promises that never again will he destroy it. Right? Rifki, go back to that language for why God decides to destroy the world in the first place. When that language that we talked about before, right, sounding almost like a jealous husband.
God says, V'chol yetzer machshavot libo, rak ra kol hayom. That the nature of man, the nature of humanity, is just bad.
Right. And look at that language, yetzer lev, right? The inclination of his heart is just evil, is bad all the days of his life. Okay, now fast forward to after the flood. Why does God say he's never again going to destroy the world?
He uses almost the same language. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra mino ra. Because the inclination, the heart of a man, is bad from his youth. It's basically saying fundamentally the same thing, that man is bad. But before he said, man is bad and therefore I have to destroy him. And now he says to Noach, man is bad and therefore I will save you and I will never do this again.
And so there's this great puzzle, which I don't think we can solve really in the context of the last few minutes of this podcast. Which is, how could the reason why God's going to destroy the world become the reason why God will never again destroy it? You know, if I was snarky, why couldn't I go back to God and say, God, you know, if you had taken a different attitude 5 minutes ago, maybe we wouldn't have had a flood, right? It's almost like there's something changing, but it's almost like what changes isn't man. And it's almost like what God is doing is sort of giving this reassurance that, yes, I know that you're evil, and right, because you can imagine Noah saying, look, how do you know if it happened once, it could happen again? How do you know people will never get this bad? You're telling me to have all these children. What if you decide to destroy them again? And God says, no, I'm not going to do that, because I'm actually looking at the reason why I destroyed you, and never again will I destroy for that reason. Why? And maybe the answer is something about the relationship has changed. There's been a reset in the relationship between God and humanity.
This is indeed where Rabbi Foreman and Rifki's conversation ends. But the truth is, I think they're really at the cusp of the significance of the parallels that they've uncovered. I think they would tell you that the significance of these parallels for them is that God gives humanity a superpower. He gives them a tool that really only a God has, which is the ability to set the reset button. God is a creator. And when a creator doesn't like his painting, his PowerPoint presentation, you paint the whole thing white. You start over. Can you do that in a marriage? A marriage is complicated. So much history. And there are transgressions in a marriage, things that you can never forget. There are suspicions of those marriage-ending events, that if only you could really know the truth, could you possibly rebuild? The flood of Noah is a devastating, destructive event. And the flood of Noah, the waters of Noah, are purifying and cause rebirth. Those two things are true simultaneously. For those who strayed, the waters destroyed them. For those that were pure, the waters ushered in a rebirth and a new era for God's relationship with man. And so seemingly we too have this tool in our relationship. We get to do something that humanity never gets to do. We get to divine the truth. Think about how crazy that is. If I wanted to go into business with somebody, I didn't know if they were going to cheat me, or if I didn't know the business venture would be successful, wouldn't it be great if there was a ritual that I could do to find out if this partner was trustworthy? Or if I knew that this venture was going to be profitable? The Torah doesn't let us peer into the future or peer into the hearts of others. It doesn't let us peer into the past to divine what was, except for the waters of the Sota. It gives a relationship a chance at rebirth, a chance at repairing. I think that's a very powerful thing. And as I'm musing and speculating about what we do with this in the 21st century, where we can't have access to that tool, I'm at least moved to know that This seems to be the most important relationship, the only relationship I know of that provides a reset tool. So it makes me think that a marriage is worth investing in, whether it makes sense to go to that therapist that Rabbi Foreman and Rifke were talking about, or whether it makes sense to do something I've never seen in my particular community but know of, a marriage renewal ceremony. Things like that start to make sense to me. And maybe those are good tools to avail yourself of, because a relationship with a spouse, with its ups and downs, its pains and disappointments, is worth investing in. As always, thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Into the Verse wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends and family about us. That really helps us to grow. And if you enjoy this podcast, please give us a rating or even write a brief review to help other listeners find us. Now, the 6 most recent episodes of Into the Verse are free, completely free, to listen to on your podcast app, while the archive of back episodes is a perk for paid members on the Aleph Beta website. Aleph Beta members also receive each week's Into the Verse transcript directly to their email to print or read online. That's handy dandy for Shabbat reading. You can find much more outstanding Torah on Aleph Beta's website at ab.video. Join the growing number of our paid subscribers who have full access to thousands of videos and podcasts on the weekly Parsha, holidays, and big ideas in Judaism. This episode was written and recorded by our lead scholar, Rabbi David Foreman, together with Rifke Stern. When this episode originally aired on Aleph Beta, it was edited by Rifke Stern. Into the Verse editing was done by Beth Lesh. The audio editor for this episode is Vikalp Sharma. Our editorial director is me, Imu Shalev. Thank you so much for listening.